Great. Well, I'm welcome. I'm so glad to connect more now. Anyway, I first say thank you to what everyone that you're doing, the innovation and the creativity and the passion that you all have been pursuing at any level is really amazing. And this partnership between public health and healthcare is going to be a core key thing to moving forward in this epidemic. I also want to thank the State Medical Association for hosting tonight. We are really trying, one of the things I have really missed in the effort to date is the ability to connect as closely with our healthcare provider community. It's been a big gap, I feel, just personally, and I have really been excited by the opportunity to now begin to fill that gap. So I appreciate the State Medical Association, Lisa Costello, who is here with us, helping out with some support. To really enabling us to begin a process, which I hope will be an ongoing two-way communication system for moving forward together. We are clearly at a challenging time with this pandemic. I'll talk a little bit about where we are in that, but really wanted to spend most of our time today just having some dialogue and conversation to address some common questions that we're getting. And then to kind of hear your issues and needs. So if we look at, just in terms of bigger picture, what's happening, as we look at the pandemic, it is clearly, we are sort of, as a state, we did not initially see a lot of disease. We then see mostly travel-related cases, the first several cases, very clearly were travel-associated. But we now, this week, have really made that transition into seeing community-based spread. We knew that would come, and it would come soon, but it has now done so. I think we're now seeing what we expected as well, that we've seen in other states, as they've identified disease across the state, that it does tend to pick up fairly quickly. And so we have had rapid increases in disease cases over the last few days. So our current latest numbers, I think they're not even on the website, but our numbers for today are that we are up to at least 52 positives across the state, and that's out of at least 1,007 individuals negatives. So we are kind of tracking the percent of positive cases that we are receiving. The negatives are actually not complete numbers because that's a delay in some of that reporting. We know more folks than that 1,007 have actually been tested and have gotten results back. But we know that the positives are the current official total. You'll also notice on the website that the numbers on the website will be a little bit behind what you see at the community level or what you hear about in your own community. And that's because of the lag time in reporting that occurs. But the official numbers are on the website each night. And again, it's around 52 currently today. So we are seeing this disease increase. We are beginning to see, as you know, facility-based issues, and that's always the area we worry about in nursing homes, other congregate settings. We are working hard and diligently, I think, and I really appreciate everyone's participation around the state to do everything that we can proactively to reduce that curve. So it goes up quickly at the beginning, and then you begin to try to see if there's anything you can do to help level it off. And again, you're trying to really flatten that curve and sustain it longer and lower so that we can really sustain the healthcare system through that. I think it's important that we began trying to do those we talk about them as social distancing, but really they are physical distancing measures early on. So we started to do that long before we ever identified our first case, and that was really important. We have increasingly tried to expand what that entails, and really now have asked everyone to buckle down and truly do everything they can for that social distancing piece and that good hand and hygiene pieces, because we are learning more about the environmental viability of the virus. And think that could be a key area as well. So we really think it's critically important to address that issue and to have everyone be a part of that solution, because that is what really is about protecting you all and the healthcare workforce as well. We are, you know, we are wrestling with, and I think we can talk more tonight about several issues. We are having to manage this truly a pandemic without all the resources we would all like to have. I have to say the testing issue has been frustrating for all of us in West Virginia and nationally. There is work underway and activity, there is expansion occurring, but I will talk more about partnerships that we can have with hospitals and others that can expand that testing. I can go into more of the details of what's behind that issue, but it has been a challenging one. We really, our focus at this point in the testing arena, what happened is the public health laboratory had to become the clinical diagnostic laboratory for the state, and that's not our usual role. And so the challenge has been really, and the real answer over time is to build out the clinical diagnostic laboratory to be able to provide COVID-19 testing, integrating it into the other testing that they do, so that we can actually have that readily available at community level in a more rapid test as well. And there are new technologies and new machines that can do that, and we've got several hospitals that are starting to move in that direction. Some are actually underway and are already testing. But the more we can build this into our routine clinical diagnostic laboratory system, the better. And then we need to have the public health laboratory go back to its mission of being the laboratory that helps with outbreak investigation and disease surveillance and those kinds of things. But at present, we're having the struggle of having to do both often because we have one of the faster turnaround times to stay in the moment. And to cover those, but we have limited resources to do it with based on the federal supplies that we've received. But there's things in the works I can talk about that are going to help with that some. We have recently changed laboratory testing criteria. So that is now, I think, in many of your email boxes. We sent that out with a dear colleague letter today. They are also on the website. And the shift is kind of as follows. Certainly testing is up to your own clinical judgment, no doubt. But recognizing that there are shortages both nationally and in the state with this issue, and that there are delays in some of our commercial laboratories, we are providing some guidelines or guidance that we could share with folks in terms of priorities for testing based on where we are currently. Those at a high level would be, first, there are certain folks that we think it's important to test because it helps people get back to work if they're critical infrastructure. And so that is testing anyone with symptoms of COVID-19 and say they work in a healthcare setting. That's a critical piece, or public safety, or institutional or congregate care settings. Any patient from those settings are going to be really important, I think, to test and diagnose. Critical infrastructure occupations, those are one core category there. Others, of course, are hospitalized patients and others who are at higher risk of the complications of disease. So people over the age of 60 and pregnant women and medical conditions that are underlying that would make them more at risk. And then the third category, is anyone who has been in close contact with a sick person that's confirmed to have COVID-19. That's getting into our case investigations, and we can talk a little more about what close contact means currently today. So I'm going to we can talk more about testing if folks would like to. The other topic that we would like to cover and make sure we kind of speak to and we can get into more of, and I'd like to hear more from you all about, is the supplies that we can make available to our healthcare workforce. It is so important that we are protecting you. You are protecting everybody else, and we need to make sure we are protecting you and your families. That we have started to get stuff in. Yesterday sent out the first supplies of any significance. We sent about 53,480 N95 masks yesterday out. Almost 50,000 surgical masks, 84,000 gloves, 12,000 face shields, 5,000 or so coveralls, and about 5,500 gowns. It is not sufficient. It is a start. And what we didn't want to do is to have What we did not want to do is to have to hold things and as they came in and not send them to you immediately. So as things have come in, we've been sending them out. So I think that means you will see things in chunks as opposed to all at once. We know it's not sufficient. We want more. There's lots of work and of orders that have been put out that we will have more coming in. But we want to make sure that we get it out to you as soon as we have it available. I'm going to stop there, I think, and just kind of open it up for questions, thoughts, ideas. And mostly then at the end, I want to think about how we make sure we maintain this communication together. Questions. One is, are the private labs also reporting to the Bureau? And that is yes. LabCorp and Quest actually report to us electronically. We have electronic lab reporting that we use every day from labs. So those two are reporting to us electronically. Some of the hospital labs that are getting up and running, WVU, CAMC, other hospital labs, some of them are reporting electronically to us. Some of them, they report in other means. So they are reporting us to, as well. So the numbers do include the private labs and the hospital lab cases, although there may be a day or so time lag as the reporting gets through the process. The negatives are actually not every lab can electronically report their negatives. And so that's why I say that the negatives are only a part of the negatives that are done. We get some of them in more weekly. So regarding COVID-19, please summarize current indications, types about testing, indications, types and sources of tests available, procedural problems, time until reporting results of various tests, and experience any difficulties. So the current indications are kind of what I shifted a minute ago to talk to, those criteria, and that is actually in your provider letter and on the website. And the thought there is, again, we're at a different stage. We're not looking for travel things now, and we're not looking just for hospitalized and high risk there, and we really have to build in this infrastructure piece. We have to address the priority of close contact investigation and outbreak investigation when we have clusters. And then we have always wanted to make sure that we have it available for our hospitalized patients for whom we are going to have to consider that diagnosis for infection control purposes or for compassionate use of medications down the road as those become available. So I think those have been the priority areas. The types and sources of tests available, the initial one was the state lab. We have a test that was run, that was by CDC, that was initially the first test that was available for this. We have that one and are still running it. And then we are also purchasing some of the newer equipment that has now been approved that can provide larger batches and faster turnarounds. So we will be doing some of that to expand our capacity as well. They are not in yet. They're not up and running, so we don't have them currently. So my testing capacity at the state lab is still pretty limited. There are extraction kits that are required and that's a back order nationally, and we don't have the full numbers we'd like to have. We keep looking for more. Other testing sources include the commercial labs. I am aware of LabCorp and Quest certainly being up and running. They are having a fairly long turnaround time, is what I'm hearing. Everywhere from 3 to 10 days sometimes. And that's the biggest challenge. They are backlogged across the country. At least our hospital facilities are, I think, CAMC and WVU. And I know Marshall has also been working and doing their own in-house testing and getting that up and running. That's just been coming online the last week or two. So that is a big step forward. And I really would encourage all of you to talk to your hospitals in your communities to see if there is any interest or ability to add that testing to your laboratory, your clinical diagnostic laboratory, because I think that is what's going to make it more readily available, is building out the system of clinical diagnostic laboratories, putting this into that. So we would be happy as a state lab. FDA has relaxed some of the, or has granted to states the ability to help some of the clinical diagnostic labs get up and running at hospitals if they would like to do that. And so if your hospital is interested in purchasing that equipment and beginning that testing, we would be happy to reach out, have you reach out to our lab and any support that we can provide. We've got our CLIA inspectors that typically do this, the work with those labs, calling and connecting with each of them to kind of see where they are. So please, if you can encourage that to happen, that'd be great. Procedural questions in terms, there's been issues with supplies. So initially, of course, this is primarily done by a nasopharyngeal swab and into a viral transport media. That's the way that it's, most of these tests are collected. You no longer have to do a nasopharyngeal and an oropharyngeal. If the nasopharyngeal is fine, a single swab is fine, and into the transport media, and then you send it to the lab, whatever your lab is that you're sending it to is. There has been shortages of the transport media and of swabs. And so the FDA did, just a week or so ago, expand the types of swabs that can be used. So if you are having challenges with finding the right swabs, there's a much bigger listing of available ones that you can access that are available in the market. So that's there. The viral transport media has been short supply as well. We are trying to get more for folks, the ones that we send out, but there has been a national shortage of that as well. There is guidance around how to make your own viral transport media, so we're asking some research labs if they could consider doing that for us, and that could be an option in the community. The other thing is you can, from a traditional viral transport media, if it's done sterilely, you can actually split it in half as long as there's a bead in each of the vials that you put it into. So a lab could actually, if they have viral transport media, they could split those in half, and as long as it's done sterilely, but you have to make sure that there's a bead in each of the vials. So those are tricks of the trade for expanding viral transport media. Some of the commercial labs, not the Office of Lab Services, but some of the commercial labs like LabCorp and others, their equipment is also authorized for some different types of specimens and for some different ways of collecting it. So, for instance, LabCorp, I hear, now will allow a nasal wash or a nasal aspirate, although you want to make sure you have an N95 mask, you're going to collect that. If you're doing the regular nasopharyngeal swab, CDC now says that, you know, you can do that simply with a face mask and eye protection and gloves there in a regular exam room with the door closed. But LabCorp is allowing the use of the wash or aspirate. They have a mechanism that you can use sterile saline to collect the swab in and send it that way. So I think the important thing is just check with your clinical laboratory that you're using to make sure what their parameters are. Given the community spread, the high number of infected people at one nursing home, and the apparent transmission from asymptomatic spread, can we provide clear recommendations on public health measures that healthcare facilities implement? Several institutions are mandating health checks before starting a shift and use of a surgical mask for all patient care. Yeah, you know, that I think are both applicable. I know we met with the long-term care folks before we ever had our first case, and they were very interested in taking the CMS guidelines around healthcare facilities, especially long-term care facilities, and being actually going above what was currently then being recommended by CDC, and we actually did that. And so we, I know at long-term care facility, they are absolutely doing that check, that screening, use of personal protective equipment, limiting visitors. And I know many of our hospitals are doing the same. So it is not unreasonable to do that. What I can say is that we should take all those measures. You know, it is still very difficult to never have it costly reduced. We know all these measures reduce the risk, but they don't eliminate it. We are seeing, and I think this is interesting with the question about using surgical masks just in general, more broadly, you know, we do see that there are people with very mild disease, and including in the nursing home, we found at least one patient that had very, very mild disease that you really would not have picked up on. But when we tested them, they were positive. So I think it is a virus that is pretty easy to transmit, that is, that even with mild symptoms, that it's possible to do that, or that it has asymptomatic spread. So it's, I think that's one of the challenges of why we're having these difficulties. Next one.
How does the curve compare to Washington?
Interesting. How does our curve compare to those of Washington State and New York? All for the availability. Okay. So we are actually looking at our curve in comparison to those. We didn't have enough cases to actually calculate it yet. We are a few days behind, of course, where those entities are. So I think we can't quite say exactly where we are yet. I'd say we're looking closer to Pennsylvania right now, not as low as what we see in Kentucky or as high as what we're seeing in New York, but I think we're too early to fully see that. We know it is increasing right now. We are trying to actually do those projections, and we will see the effects of what's undertaken. But that's why we all keep saying, please, you know, follow the stay-at-home order, really, really make this effort sincere, because we really do know, I think there's 200 and some literature studies now that speak to the fact that strong and robust, usually voluntary, but really robust community mitigation measures are probably the most effective thing that we can do.
Doing contact tracing at
Sundale. Is someone doing contact tracing at Sundale? Yes. So when there is a case in a nursing home, we actually, the local health department, in consultation with the state, and then we've been pulling in other partners, have been immediately doing the case and contact and outbreak investigation. So in the nursing home, that case immediately was investigated. They looked at other residents across in the nearby area of that nursing home who else had symptoms. They actually ended up testing not just those with symptoms, but actually all the residents in that wing initially. And then we also looked at what staff have been in contact with the patient. And so then you start to test the applicable staff. And then depending on what you find, you begin to expand that out to other parts of the facility. And so it is a very robust, active, it's been a very quick but challenging response. So we actually involved the National Guard because they helped with some of the testing. Capacity, et cetera. We also, they involved partners such as WVU to help with testing. We did some of the testing, they did some of the testing. So yes, there's actually a very active contact investigation, outbreak investigation in nursing homes. We do have some tools that are available for nursing homes in terms of kind of the guidance around doing an outbreak investigation with one of these.
How long can you reuse an N95 mask?
What are you all doing? What's been the practice that you've been finding?
Reusing N95 masks, how many days can you reuse them?
I don't know there's a magic answer with that. you know, depends on how it's getting used and how you store it. There is the guidance out from CDC about conserving, and I guess I'd refer you to that. You know, we don't like to have to keep reusing them. I think we're kind of in unprecedented times in some ways. Let's see if we can find more information on that. Anybody else on the call know that information or seen that?
We'd just like to.
I don't
one.
Think that there is an indication to be able to use them again. I don't think that is recommended, but certainly required during this time.
CDC has three ways to do masks, and one of which is by what we all were taught. The second one is reuse, and the third one is to use bandanas, which is a joke. But we've been spraying our N95 mask, which we've been using for 3 weeks, with 70% isopropyl alcohol.
I've heard people
doing that. I
don't
know if this is... I was just going to offer, I'm on a COVID group, and someone is saying to take 4 masks if you can get them and rotate them every day so that every day you're wearing one that is over 3 days old, and hanging the other ones out to dry because of the virus only lasting 3 days.
That's interesting. Yeah, we're learning more about environmental survival of the virus. The last study I saw about 4 hours on copper, about 24 hours on cardboard, and on stainless steel and plastic, it was around up to a couple of days. So there is environmental survival. So that's interesting about the 3 days. That would kind of be interesting and make sense.
We don't have enough N95.
There's some information that's come out of Stanford University about reuse. I'll try to send it in this chat. They've definitely recommended not spraying the N95s with isopropyl alcohol or with chlorine, just because it breaks down the electrostatic property of the mask, which is really what the viral filtering efficiency is made up of. I'll see if I can't send that to you.
That would be great. One thing that I love about these calls is we all are learning things, and so we can share it more. And I've also heard people do it with hand gels. I'm not so, that would also have the alcohol in it, so I'm not so sure that's the approach either. Dr. Whitaker, you were asking, did we get a large shipment yesterday and was out in 3 to 4 hours? But this is about PPE. We sent everything we got in yesterday, and this was some of our federal supply. We sent out, and it went out to local health departments, to hospitals, and then also to the broader healthcare system. So that was including primary care and hemodialysis centers and EMS and behavioral health and a list of other home health. It was meant for all of those groups. There is a separate supply that we ordered that not from the federal supply, but a separate supply the state purchased. That is coming in gradually, and 30% of that is actually to go to police, fire, and law enforcement arena. And then the 70% of that, which is coming in, and it's not here yet, is an additional supply for healthcare workforce. There was questions about zithromycin, chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and actually others in the call could probably speak even better to this than I could. They certainly are interesting new developments. I think my understanding is the zithromycin and the combination with azithromycin was actually based on a study out of France, I believe. Pretty small study, but was showing some promise. I think all of these are still in the area of we need some clinical trials to really understand their use. I don't think they are at a point that we are really thinking about regular use routinely. It would be in a hospitalized, very ill patient, like in terms of thinking of how to use it in that setting potentially. But I'd actually open that up to other people on the call that have really done some further consideration of that or are treating patients.
I understand that it's limited to infectious disease approval in facilities.
And I don't know if that is a facility-based policy or something broader.
And a lot of times, I believe it's a WVU medicine-based policy.
Right. A lot of times, the hospital itself will have a policy around if you're going to do something, if you're going to use that kind of a treatment, that you would have to go through infectious disease consultation.
The problem is, in remote facilities, we are limited in infectious disease support.
Right. So, but that would be a facility policy, right? So, could you do a consult or not?
You can do a consult, but we're limited in the ability. So the current recommendation is to page the on-call ID person, attending resident, I don't know who, in Morgantown, and most of the time you can't get them to call you back.
Maybe that's something we can follow up and just let them know. Yeah.
And if you're in rural West Virginia, there's no such thing as an ID.
Exactly, and that's what I'm speaking to. Now, I have called both of my local pharmacies. I have two local pharmacies in a small town who both have, I would say, currently adequate supplies of hydroxychloroquine. But if we're getting notices from the State Board of Pharmacy, as well as the larger entities, that we're not allowed to prescribe it without ID consultation, that's not reasonable. And I'm not asking to prescribe it to anybody who thinks they may have it or has minimal symptoms. I'm sending people home daily who could have it, but they're clinically well controlled on Tylenol, and I'm telling them to go home and ride it out. But I'm saying for the people who are at high risk, have high incidence of comorbidity, those are the people who eventually could be considered for that. So is my pharmacist going to tell me that I can't prescribe it?
You know, I think it's a great topic. Actually, we're going to be trying to do a treatment, a webinar coming up, actually, more on treatment and management, and get some experts that can really speak to some of those issues. So that, I think, is coming up later.
I'm sorry. WVU Medicine released today recommendations for treatment for adults as well as pediatrics. And so they at least have recommended those treatments to outpatient versus inpatient physicians. But again, as an outpatient physician in a rural area, they didn't provide any guidance as to whether or not I can actually send that prescription to the pharmacy and have it released.
I think this is Lee Tussell. I've been working with Dr. Slemp. I think that's a great point, what you made. And the pulmonologists were actually the groups of the main pulmonology intensivist groups around the states kind of got together to come up with a streamlined protocol. I think what we could do from hearing this feedback is talk to our ID specialists around the state at the major groups and see if we could come up with some similar guidance that we could then push out to those in rural communities, and then talk about the potential of using like the medical access referral line, whereas if you do have a question for an ID doctor, because the Board of Pharmacy did place out a statement based upon what they're allowed to require. So I think it's great feedback, and we can reach out to the ID teams to see if they could perhaps get together similarly like our pulmonary intensivists did, because that's what they were hearing, that the rural doctors really needed some resources. And it clearly sounds like the same be done for the issue that you're presenting.
And I think as they talk about treatment, they too would include those kinds of treatments is what we need to think of that. You know, the reason that the Board of Pharmacy letter came out, and many of you probably know this, there were challenges and issues with providers writing prescriptions to just kind of hold on to these medications for themselves, their families, just in case somebody needed it. And so it was actually depleting supplies that were needed to be used for routine use of these. In addition, there were folks that were trying to take it prophylactically. and frankly, at least one person has died from that.
That was unfortunate and uneducated, for sure. But sure. If I just want to make sure that if we do have these panels to have to float our expertise through, one, do we have enough ID specialists or pulmonologists to man that? And two, are they communicating appropriately and effectively, I guess, and efficiently with the Board of Pharmacy? So if I see a patient whom I feel that that would benefit. And to note, that hasn't happened yet, but I know we're on the uptick. So if it does, and I send to one of my two local remote pharmacies, will they have the information to know that, yes, I can take that order, and yes, I can release that medication?
Well, those are great questions and great feedback. So would it be helpful to have sort of some common templates about treatment protocols and then the referral processes that you would need to support that? And then we'll have to talk to Board of Pharmacy about how to make sure we implement those. But those are great.
I've been unable to get a return call from ID when I've inquired about that.
Dr. Wade and the other caller, I'm sorry, I couldn't recognize your name on your voice on the call. If you would send your email address to the info@wvsma.org, we will follow up with you tomorrow on that, because they are certainly great points, and we'll follow up directly with you. And then once we have a more developed protocol, we can disseminate that to the larger group if we can work on having things like that developed or coordinated.
Well, some of the
how do I get added to that list?
Some of the guidelines say you have to have a positive test, but if it takes 3 to 14 days, that doesn't work.
Yeah, that's where it really does need to be built out in our clinical diagnostic system. And that's, you know, right now the availability with the correct turnaround time is either those places that have that, or the state lab, we're the other one that can do about 24-hour turnaround. We are in urgent situations. You know, we certainly are doing that as long as we can have our services available with that.
And the problem that I'm having is tremendous. I'm subjecting my employees to the virus, and we're out in rural West Virginia with no N95 masks, really, apparently. And with a terrible disease, and that's not fair to my employees.
I agree. Same situation.
I think the other thing particularly pertinent to rural practices is if I'm the only physician in my practice, if God forbid, I would contract this disease, and certainly I am blessed to currently have an N95 mask that I can spray with Lysol and dry in the sun, but nonetheless, If I do contract the disease, the medical care within a 50-mile radius is gone.
No, you guys are critical. I hear you.
I have been able to get masks from a local hardware store. I know the owner, and they basically have pulled aside any N95s. They're still able to get their industrial N95s, but pretty helpful. And it really just takes accessing different supply chains. They're out there. They probably won't be out there forever, but they are out there.
Yeah, there are some. And then, you know, there are dentist offices and other places that have shared that if they've closed, or ambulatory surgical centers, if they've canceled their elective surgeries and have supplies, they have. It is a real issue. The real answer is we've got to get more to you. And we have got purchase orders in. And as they come, we will get them to you. I wish it was there now. There is no doubt. It's one of the most frustrating parts of all of this. The other thing is, please do check with your local health department. They did get some supplies it goes through the full healthcare system in that community. That's just an avenue for distribution there. So check with your local health department to see what their supply is now. Can they go one or two or something? And then we will keep sending more. So this was just the first shipment. But we need them. There is no question. Telemedicine, is that the question? Yeah, limited Wi-Fi for video telemedicine. So there's a lot evolving around telemedicine, and actually I think we might like to do a whole session on that coming up shortly. We've been talking about that. The modalities available for telemedicine under this are actually not simply video. It can be audio only. So a phone consultation only is allowable. There's a whole host of other possible methodologies there. And so I think we probably ought to have just a whole conversation around the telemedicine arena soon.
But today I had several opportunities to try to triage patients that had comorbidities, and they had straight Medicaid, or Medicare rather. Humana, PEIA, and several allow telemedicine via any available option, but CMS does not. They're declining allowing telephonic only. And in my area, my patients simply say, I don't have Wi-Fi, doc. So we're being asked to do the impossible with, can you talk to CMS? I can't talk to them.
I know for Medicaid, they're allowing that, and it's in the 1135 waiver, which has been filed, and will be retroactive back to the date of the emergency declaration. So let me find out, because my understanding is that is allowable for both Medicare and Medicaid.
I understand that Medicaid allows it for a $12 reimbursement and a 0.25 RVU.
Yeah. Why don't we, these are lots of good questions around this. Why don't we get, we will make sure that we've got a couple of experts that are dealing with this issue to have a whole presentation on this shortly. Is that a topic that would be helpful for you all, or what?
Yes.
Okay. We will work on getting that one soon. This is interesting. Reports from patients who rent vacation homes in West Virginia and are booking large and small groups of people from New York, New Jersey, and Ohio to come weather out the storm in West Virginia. They stay in their house. I assume they go grocery shopping, et cetera, when they arrive.
I'm curious, what is that from?
I'm sorry, what?
I said, I'm sorry, I'm curious, what is that from? What is that coming from?
The question we're getting is, there are people that are coming from New York, New Jersey to stay in vacation homes in West Virginia.
And that was my question.
Yeah.
I'm in the Eastern Panhandle, but I have some patients that rent in Morgan County, and then also some folks that had contacted them mistakenly for other folks renting south of Morgantown, where there was like one group of like 15 teenagers all coming from DC, another group of family members from New York and New Jersey meeting other family members from Ohio. I think folks I've heard this from other people. They've been, made these requests at the time when we quote unquote didn't have any positives. But I'm just, I don't know if these folks that are renting need to be discouraged from taking these groups of people. Maybe something like that from the state level that just discourages that would be appropriate.
That's interesting. That's an interesting thought. Yeah, I could see that. And they certainly, if they're here, they need to follow our stay-at-home orders. But that is a concerning issue. You know, then this is one of the challenges. I mean, our borders are porous, and they're not. They're just kind of artificial, but so we can't creep things out. We know it's here, but don't want to add more. Sure.
That would be an interesting phenomenon to discuss with the governor.
Yeah, it would. It would. I know they did do, for that purpose, they did close the lodges at the state parks. They closed the Hatfield-McCoy Trail, kind of big tourist venues that come in. I hadn't thought of the homes. I mean, those are people's homes that they stay in or rent out. So this one says, this is a very fluid situation. Boy, is that ever true. Currently, the CDC recommends 2 negative tests 24 hours apart before returning a healthcare worker back to work after a positive test for COVID-19. Do you think, given the limited testing capacity and the strain on healthcare providers, that 1 negative test for our area could be considered appropriate? There's actually revised guidance out about that. And I would encourage you to go to the CDC website, and it does talk about, ways that you might do the ideal, but also when you have to be practical with it, when to return folks. So there is some evolving and new guidance on that, I think. we should put that in an FAQ question for folks and pull that out. Any problems with hoarding of PPE or trial drugs like hydroxychloroquine? Well, we know the issue around hydroxychloroquine, that was happening and was an issue. You all have to tell me more about hoarding of PPE. What are you seeing?
If you're a private doc, there isn't any available.
Yeah.
We have none, and we're triaging patients, again, putting our employees at risk several times a day.
My guess is there's not much hoarding, there's not much there right now. And I think, you know, it will be important as we move forward and the flow begins that folks really do work across the sectors and systems to share where they can and to make sure everybody's covered some, you know, because when you send these things out, you can't, there's no good distribution way to make sure you get exactly what. And so I think it really is good. We will send as much as we can get and send. And then I hope community systems will really work together to make sure that everybody is covered, because you're referring to each other, you've got the same patient, you all benefit from everybody having something.
The doctor on the president's panel, Dr. Birx, today reaffirmed that the homemade hand-sewn cotton masks are basically effective only to prevent the wearer from touching their face, but don't offer any filtration. And that's what we're using under a surgical mask. Do you have a feeling about that, all these cloth masks that are being made?
I don't. I think I would just use a surgical mask with a surgical mask, an N95 mask with an N95 mask. I don't know that there's any evidence that putting one on top of the other actually is effective. If there's others that people are hearing about this, let me know. This the beauty of these dialogues. I guess the sense I've had with the cloth masks and the homemade mask, and it's a wonderful initiative. People are really wanting to help out. I think it does have a barrier for not putting your hands to your mouth and your nose. So it would protect the individual wearing it from that angle. It's certainly not going to filter out things. It would protect if someone coughed and sneezed right nearby them. It doesn't fall on your mouth or your nose there, in areas there. So I think from that angle it can be protective, but it really is meant, I think they're best used in the community. So I think we've got lots of essential service workers that are out. We have people that are needing to go do home visitations and child protective service work. A simple surgical mask, or if needed, the cloth masks are probably the most effective there. And really to have our true surgical masks retained for healthcare workers would be my preference. Other thoughts that you all have? Because I'd love your guidance on what we should be saying about these. Is that the message? What message is best for us to give from your perspective?
I've felt pretty strongly about the cloth masks from the very onset of hearing that our hospital systems were putting out calls for volunteers. There's good evidence out there that says the cloth masks increase transmission. They actually make people touch their face a little bit more. Plus, once they've removed them, they put them in their pockets, they put them in things, you know, and they just breed more moisture and problems. To that end, I know that the hospital system, at least in Charleston, has instructed employees not to use them. There is evidence out there for those who have no other option, however, that introduction of HEPA filters, you can literally strip a HEPA filter. You can find this stuff on there, but they've studied these and said that there is effectiveness to the protection of that. It just makes it extremely difficult to breathe through it.
Yeah.
So there's a trade-off to the protection.
Yeah.
You know, obviously this is not an ideal circumstance and we have to just work with what we have. And I think a HEPA filter inside of two cotton pieces is better than nothing for people who have nothing. I won't say that the cotton, mask alone is better than nothing. I think it honestly is potentially creates a risk for at least providers.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it with a provider at all with that. I'd love if you send the science of what you're referencing to. It'd be good to see.
Sure, absolutely.
We're all learning as we go with this and kind of trying to make the best of a difficult situation. I think it does help people feel more comfortable, but if they're not, it's like gloves. You know, gloves are only effective if you don't touch your face with your hands with the gloves on. And so I think it's again, how you use these things. Any other key ones here? They've got some great. Let me do one other topic here as these questions sort of begin to get at. You know, we clearly are not going to be testing every individual that has symptoms compatible with COVID-19. We do know that it seems to spread fairly easily. Obviously, much more than flu. And we are at a stage in our curve that we really are trying to reduce as much spread as possible. And so, you know, I wonder, and I would like to get your all thoughts on this. You know, much of this we're going to have to treat clinically. And I know you were doing that. But the guidance, you know, I wonder what is now the time that we really say to anyone that has symptoms compatible with it, that you just treat it as if you assumed it was positive. Now that would mean that the person stays home for at least 7 days, and then if they have a fever, you need to be at least 3 days after the fever resolves off of antipyretics. So that the minimum is 7 days, and then three days after the resolution of fever. That also means that their contacts would be self quarantining and observing until we either knew that the person usually 14 days in your last exposure. So I'm just interested in you know, do we in some ways that helps people stay home more with that so that they can begin to break the cycle of spread even further. But I'm just interested in what you all are doing in that arena.
I think that somewhat depends on where we're at, where you think we are. You know, if we still have, that's what listening to the presidential address yesterday, we're talking about rural states with more testing being online to really attack those positives and find their contacts and really work in that venue that public health could really impact rural states if we think we have the resources to do that.
Yeah, we are doing that contact investigation, that tracing, but it is not uncommon to find somebody new each time we do it, because that's where you're going to find most. But it is definitely here. We, you know, the more we look, the more you find it. And it is spreading pretty quickly, pretty easily. We've got new counties every day coming online. And again, you know, we're not seeing them being travel related now. They are community based, many of them.
Is the finger stick antibody serology that's been talked about on a federal level, that even reality to help the return to work process?
Serology, and you looked that up the other day. It's in development, but not. There you go.
Yeah, I think if you send that letter, I mean, we were looking at different literature because we've been getting that question asked a considerable amount, and it seems like at least Johns Hopkins is looking at developing some, but there had not been any validated test yet because it's still unclear the amount of immunity that you'll be able to amount a response to. So I think, you know, that's something that's still ongoing, but there's certainly no recommendations out there that we could have found from the CDC yet. I think that's something still in development, and as that test becomes available, it'll have to be determined how it'll be clinically useful in the situation that you described.
Yeah. The other
I'm getting a lot of those questions as well from local industry in the Mid-Ohio Valley. So if the president is on talking about the ability to test that serology, trying to explain to them that, one, we can prove antibody presence, but we cannot yet prove the presence of antibodies and its effectiveness on preventing disease.
Yeah. We don't know yet. It's not been long enough to know how long, if we do develop antibody, how long, and is it really protective, and how long? Yeah. We do not know.
So how should we be instructing our local industries?
Well, I don't think we're using it clinically, really, at this point. We'll get back on more on that with that, but I don't know. There is a question here I just want to clarify, too. There was a question about an unconfirmed report of a death associated with COVID at one of the hospitals in the western part of the state. There was a death. It was not a West Virginia resident. And so when there is a case that the resident actually is from another state, it gets counted in their totals. We track these numbers across states and across the country by the state of residence. I think we really want to make sure that we continue this. So I really want to say thank you, because I really appreciate the opportunity to listen, to hear, to learn from each of you. It's really, really wonderful. And so I hope this is the first of many. We are working to make sure that we have ongoing ones. We're going to partner with different associations to host some of these and to have an ongoing both dialogue and some webinar presentations on the topics that we're hearing from you. So things like telehealth and management and treatment. And I think those, I'd love to do those and listen and learn and think how we go through this together, because I think staying connected is going to be so important. I would open it up for one last kind of any comments that what's helpful for you, or topics you would like to have to hear on these, or other kind of feedback that you can provide for what we've done today.
I'd just like to thank you for your help.
Oh, this is definitely a team effort.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to have the dialogue. Number one, that's very important, especially for those of us practicing in rural areas. Very interested to see how treatment protocols roll out in the near future.
Great. Other topics that would be really helpful?
This is Whitaker. I think it almost has to go fluid because it's changing so rapidly. What we say is a good topic now, in a week may not be.
Yeah, you are correct. So I think maybe the key there is staying connected so we can adapt it as we go. So I think that is wise advice. I guess in closing, I just want to say thank you. You know, you all are right on the front line. You are dealing with this every day. I know there is sacrifices that you are doing with family and others. It is not easy. My team is doing the same, and we are clearly in this together. And I think the more we can stay connected, communicate, share ideas, and learn from each other, the better. So I just want to say thank you for joining us today. I look forward to more. Thanks to the Medical Association for hosting it today. This time we'll work with other partners to do the same kind of thing, and that I look forward to working with you together. It's sometimes a difficult challenge, I know, but I think all of us together are better than any one of us alone. So we will continue to move forward. Thanks. So
thank you all for joining. This webinar was recorded and will be posted on the coronavirus.wv.gov website. We also provide other resources that we update very frequently. Check back to there frequently, and thank you for joining this evening.